Welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Good morning, and welcome to another Community Conversation with your Tuesday hosts, Phil Huff and Julie Callawine. Good morning, Julie.
Well, hello, Phil. How are you doing?
I am doing well. It's getting ever more spring-like, and a little extra snap in my step today. Idaho finally allowed appointments to be made for age 55 and up. Not that we want to give anything away. So I have my COVID vaccine appointment in a couple weeks.
That's great, Phil. I went on the website today, just today. I don't have an appointment yet, but I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that I will have one soon also. Yeah. Well, that's a big event, Phil, and I'm happy to hear that. What else is going on?
Well, it gives us hope that maybe someday in the not too distant future, we'll be back in the studio doing these things live. But otherwise, yeah. I'm looking forward to, we broadcast this on Tuesday, but we recorded them the week before. I'm looking forward to the weekend that now was, and the hope that this sunny weather continues.
Yes, so true. And it's so interesting this time of year in Sandpoint, because down here in the valley, we're in springtime. We see green grass, no new birds are arriving, and yet we still have skiing up on the mountain in Schweitzer and in the backcountry. And Phil, I was skiing today at Schweitzer. It was a great sunny day, and I took the worst wipeout I've taken since I was a ski racer. It was the yard sale of the century, and everybody up on the triple got to see me do it. Very embarrassing.
Oh, yeah, I try to do mine in the back country that way, but yeah,
spring
conditions, and that's a great segue into today's topic. So we're going to cover sort of all things winter snow.
Yes, we are. And our guests today are the Winter Wildlands Alliance programs and projects. It's the Winter Wildlands Alliance, and we're talking about programs and projects, of course. And our guests today are Hillary Eisen. She's the policy director of the Winter Wildlands Alliance. Hello, Hillary.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
Yes, I'm great. And then our second guest today is David Page. And David, you are the advocacy director. Hello, David.
Hello, Julie. Hello, Phil. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great.
We're really excited you're on, and Hillary is an old hand at this. I think we last talked to Winter Alliance a year and a half or so ago, and this sounded like a good time to delve into what's going on and get some updates on long-range work that the Alliance is doing, and also talk about some of the programs that are coming to a close this season. We like to start first with the personal touch. Our audience likes to know more about who it is we're talking to. And so, Hillary, why don't we start with you and give us a little bit of your background and how you came to work in this industry and why it motivates you to do so.
Sure, Phil. I live in Bozeman, Montana. So it was a pleasure to be able to visit Sandpoint last fall, or maybe it was two falls ago. I think 2020 kind of this is just one big blur for me, but it was a pleasure to be able to visit Sandpoint in the fall, whenever that was that I did that. And normally though, I'm here in Bozeman, and I have been working for Winter Wildlands Alliance for about 7 years now, and working in the realm of conservation policy and advocacy for about 13 years. My sort of education background is in science and biology, wildlife biology, and conservation biology. And I got into conservation advocacy work in winter wildlands in particular because of my love of being outdoors. So I really enjoy backcountry skiing, rock climbing, ice climbing, backpacking, you know, just being in wild places and doing stuff outside. And a few years after college, I realized that I could actually do work to protect the places that I like to recreate in. And one thing led to another, and here I am.
David, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and also how you came to be interested in and find yourself working for the Winter Wildlands Alliance?
Sure. Yeah, unlike Hillary, I didn't necessarily study environmental policy, but I grew up in the mountains in Colorado and New Mexico and ended up out here in Eastern California in the big mountains of the Sierra Nevada. And so it's something that's always been passion of mine. Understanding kind of how lands are managed. I was a freelance writer for about a decade before I came into this. And at some point, as I was doing my freelance writing hustle and spending more and more time volunteering on nonprofit boards, doing similar work to what I do now, but not getting paid for it, my wife said, you know, why don't we flip this around and you should maybe get a job doing that and you can do the writing on the side. And so, I met Mark Menlove at Winter Wildlands Alliance, and it just happened there was an opening in advocacy, and Hillary took me under her wing and taught me everything I know, and it was kind of trial by fire. And now we work, even though we're, you know, half a country apart, we work in hand every day on a whole range of things. It's super exciting, and yeah, that's where we are.
Yeah, so tell us a little more about the WWA, the Winter Wildlands Alliance, history, mission, et cetera.
Yeah, so we are a national organization based in Boise, so Idaho based, but national in scope, and have been around for about 21 years. And our roots are, Winter Wildlands came about from a number of smaller organizations, including the Nordic and Backcountry Skiers Alliance down in Sun Valley, Wood River Valley area of Idaho. And so it's little groups of skiers that were wrestling with land management issues and fighting to protect quiet places for skiing. And they started to realize that these sorts of conversations were happening, not just in Idaho, but also in California and in Colorado and all across the country. And so leaders from these different groups came together and they created a national organization, Winter Wildlands Alliance. And our mission is, I'm not going to be able to quote it perfectly here, but it is to protect wild places and opportunities for quiet winter recreation. We have three programs under that mission. So there's the policy and advocacy program, which is David and I's work. We also have a snow school program, which is an outdoor education program that can be, it's a curriculum that we've developed that can be modified for anybody from, you know, kindergarten through high school, but generally aimed at elementary age kids that teaches kids about snow science and winter ecology and also just introduces them to the outdoors and winter and sort of the fun that goes along with that. And we also have our Backcountry Film Festival, which I know tours the Sandpoint every year. And that is a, you know, a winter focused film festival that is all about highlighting the human powered winter experience. It's not just ski movies. There's snowshoeing, ice climbing, I believe there's been dog sledding, winter surfing, but all these different cool films highlighting things that people do in winter under their own power and telling really inspiring stories. And the purpose of the film festival is to bring the backcountry community together and inspire people to, you know, be advocates and just also to, again, get excited about winter. David, do you have anything to add to that very brief synopsis?
No, that's great. And I guess the only thing I would add is just that small alliance of two or three groups a couple decades ago has now grown to well over 30 groups stretching from Vermont, New Hampshire to, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, all across the country grappling with all kinds of different issues. Whether it's land management planning with the Forest Service or ski area expansions or protecting roadless areas, working on climate issues, legislation, it's really grown to be quite a big a big project.
So tell us just a little more. I want to delve into this some. What I'm hearing is that the actual organization, Winter Wildlands Alliance, is a fairly small, nimble staff. And then it's supported by a true alliance of smaller grassroots groups that are probably a mixture of some paid advocates and a whole lot of volunteers. Is that the model?
Yeah, totally. Our heart is really in our grassroots and our membership. So we have, I think right now we have 5 staff, which is very small, even for a small nonprofit. We're on the small side, and certainly for a national nonprofit. But as David said, you know, we have, I think it's 34 grassroots groups and countless members as well. And each of those grassroots groups has their own membership. And so I think of us in some ways like one of those nesting dolls where there's all these different layers and we all work together. And so we provide, in the policy side of things, we provide sort of a national perspective and expertise on land management and legislation and policy, but we pair that always with grassroots activists, whether it's an official grassroots group or individuals who are, you know, members of Winter Wildlands or other groups that are partners of ours. You know, we can't know everything about every place. And so we really rely on the local knowledge of our grassroots partners. And then we help support them and bring that sort of national perspective and expertise to their work.
And so, you know, just again to talk a little bit more about how this model functions, having some background with advocacy work and in a not dissimilar manner, how united are those groups in their views? When you present a policy proposal, is this something where pretty much everybody's in agreement, or are there a range of opinions on any given topic that are represented?
I would say on the big picture topics, there's pretty good unity across our grassroots network. Each grassroots group has sort of their own pet issues that they're working on. So our grassroots groups in New England are focused on pretty different issues than our grassroots groups in Idaho or Montana or California, just because of the landscape and the way that backcountry skiing is different in Idaho versus New Hampshire. So there are some issues that we're working with certain grassroots groups that other groups just don't have an opinion on, maybe. And then there's other issues that affect everybody. And in general, we have pretty cohesive unity across the backcountry community or across the Winter Wildlands family.
Hillary, tell us just a couple of policies that happen either across the country and then some of the specific ones that people might not agree on. I'm just wanting to understand what types of issues you're grappling with.
Totally. And I'll let David add to this as well. But I think there's sort of two camps of things that we grapple with. One is land management, particularly Forest Service, because that's where the majority of backcountry skiing occurs, Forest Service land management. And that can be forest planning, which is big picture, you know, kind of 30,000 foot view of how a forest is going to be managed, type planning, all the way down to a very specific project. We do a lot of work with winter travel management planning, which people have very strong opinions about, as well as we also get involved in things like, you know, if there's a timber sale that's going to impact the way people recreate in that area in the winter, for better or worse, we'll get involved and speak up for the human-powered backcountry community and make sure that, you know, the timber sale happens in a way that doesn't harm backcountry skier interests. Or another issue we've been, I think, working more and more on lately is ski resort expansions. And we're not opposed to ski resort expansions, but we do want to make sure that the air, you know, often there are important backcountry skiing locations adjacent to ski areas, and we don't want to lose those. And so we'll advocate for protecting, you know, important backcountry areas from being developed into ski resorts. And those are things that when you get into the nitty-gritty details, you can have some differing opinions for sure. Generally, the backcountry ski community is pretty united, once again, on the big picture stuff. And then aside from that, like land management policy work that we do, and the other kind of bucket of issues that we grapple with is the backcountry community is growing. There are way more backcountry skiers than there were 10 years ago, certainly more than 20 years ago when Winter Wildlands was founded. And there's a lot of other activities happening in the winter backcountry now. You know, 20 years ago, there was telemark skiers and snowmobilers. Now you've got, you know, telemark skiers, split boarders, alpine skiers, snowmobilers, timber sledders, you know, fat bikers, you have all these different uses, and we're all looking, you know, we're all out there to have a good time in the backcountry. But as we have more and more people, inevitably there's going to be some difficulties. And so we also have worked with our grassroots groups to figure out, like, how do we manage not just everybody else's use, but our own use? You know, we kind of have to think about, how do we get along as a community? How do we make sure that, you know, a lot of what people love about backcountry skiing is solitude and opportunity for exploration and adventure. And if you're out there with 1,000 of your closest friends, you may not be able to find those experiences without some effort. And so how do we preserve the very core of what backcountry skiing historically has been, while also wanting our community to grow? How do we go through these growing pains in a way that's going to be, you know, a good outcome for everybody? And that's something that's really come into sharp focus in the last year, for sure, as COVID has led to a real boom in backcountry recreation.
Yeah, that's a great segue. And then it sounds like the main challenges are the potential expansion of other interests, incursions into the backcountry, whether it's a ski resort or increase of various uses. But then there's the increased body of use, if you will, amongst the backcountry skiers and other silent users, creating its own manifestation of challenges. I'd imagine there's some look at the impact on the non-recreation landscape, wildlife issues. How has that been, what's been going on in that arena over the last several years?
Yeah, that's a big part of our work. So we're not just a backcountry skiing advocacy organization, we're a conservation organization, and we want to make sure that our activities don't have a negative impact on the environment and on wildlife. And so we have been involved with kind of helping the ski community understand what the latest and greatest science is around wildlife. You know, there's a growing body of research about winter recreation and wildlife, and some really interesting studies about wolverines and bighorn sheep. And so communicating those studies to our membership and is part of what we do. And then also understanding, you know, I think the main takeaway that we are seeing in regard to wildlife in particular is, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. Like, yes, animals have unique, you know, kind of specific reactions to specific activities, but across the board, the more people there are in the backcountry, in an animal's habitat, the more impact they are going to have. You know, if you have one skier in an area, they might not make much of a dent. But if you have 100 skiers in that area, the critters might decide that maybe they want to be somewhere else. And it's the same with snowmobiling. One snowmobiler may not be a big deal. 100 snowmobilers is a very different story. And so understanding that we all have an impact, and certainly nobody's trying to harm wildlife. You know, everybody is, you know, across the board, anyone we talk to, you know, loves the wildlife. So it's understanding the sort of cost of our own use and how we can mitigate that. And, you know, that it's not, you know, not every place is equally important for wildlife. And so understanding, you know, where are those really important habitat areas and how can we avoid them? What sort of ways in which we travel? Like if a particular area, if like it's important to have predictable use, so animals maybe can habituate if you're on a trail versus off trail. So maybe staying on a trail through a particular place and then going off trail, just understanding how wildlife react to human use and what we can do to minimize those reactions and make sure that, you know, we can continue to enjoy the backcountry and continue to have healthy and happy wildlife populations out there with us.
You've mentioned COVID, and certainly listeners of our show have heard Julie and I talk to a number of people this last year about the increased use of public lands. We've mainly focused in on the summer aspect of that. And of course, I think everybody's seen firsthand this huge spike in interest in recreation on our public lands in the summertime. That's carried over through the winter, it sounds like. Tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were all braced for it and anticipating it. And indeed, I think we've seen, I've certainly not seen a season like this in terms of how many people are out in the backcountry with new setups. And I was just out in Jackson Hole for my teenager's Nordic races, and to see the amount of tracks on Teton Pass is really extraordinary. So there's been just a huge boom in backcountry skiing, and that's certainly spiked over the last year. And you know, I think for the most part, that's something I think we want to be excited about, because we appreciate that that more and more folks appreciate what we do, and you know, we hope that translates to caring for the environment and advocating for the protections that we all care about. But by the same token, you know, there's a lag in education, and there's a lag in sort of that social change and responsibility, and that's something that we've been trying to work to catch up to as well.
Tell us about some of the specific ways it's shifted the work that both of you do with policy and advocacy, and maybe some of the increased challenges that it's created for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think just like everybody, it seems, you know, our work has gone virtual. So David and I, in a normal year, would be on the road a lot, traveling all over the West and to DC. And, you know, I think over the 7 years I've been at Winter Wildlands, generally, I would be gone for at least a week every month for work travel. And I haven't gone anywhere since this time last year. I think actually the last thing I did before the pandemic hit was go on a backcountry ski trip in Canada, and that was great. But so our, you know, our work has shifted to virtual, which has really, there's been some silver linings to that. So, you know, just in the same way that we can do a radio interview with you guys in Sandpoint and, you know, be thousands of miles away, we're able to meet with partners. And granted, we could have done this before, it just didn't really occur to anybody, I don't think, that, you know, there, we have these virtual platforms to be able to hold meetings with partners and stakeholders from many different places, and have it without the hassle and expense of travel. So that's opened up some opportunities to have conversations we maybe wouldn't have been able to have. So there's certainly been some good things. Of course, it's hard to substitute for the quality that comes from real in-person, face-to-face time spent. So that, you know, that's taken some adjusting. But as far as day-to-day policy work, you know, the wheels of federal land management keep on turning. There was certainly some delays in some of the processes that we've worked on, but a lot of our day-to-day work has remained the same, you know, insofar as, you know, responding to Forest Service land management decisions and engaging in those, and just the ways in which we engage have changed slightly. Our other programs, I think, have probably seen more significant impact from COVID. So Snow School, for instance, is a, you know, generally it's a field trip based program where you load up an entire classroom or an entire grade full of kids onto a bus and you take them somewhere snowy and you spend the day outside with them. And, you know, that's not happening either because schools aren't doing in-person learning, or even if they are, they're certainly not cramming all the kids onto a school bus and taking them on a field trip. And our Snow School program director was able to create these really awesome Snow School at Home videos and online resources for anybody to use. So it's allowed Snow School to actually increase its reach and also give it the resources for parents who are trying to figure out what to do with their kids for yet another day. And you know, those resources can also be used for in-person learning where that's occurring, but it allows the Snow School program to, you know, have that wider reach. And then our Backcountry Film Festival, which normally, you know, you cram as many people as you can into a theater and it's kind of a party and it's this really, you know, fun experience with, you know, a lot of fundraising. It's the Backcountry Film Festival's one of the most important fundraisers for our, particularly our grassroots groups. Sometimes it's the only fundraiser, and they do a lot of, you know, beer sales and raffle sales and stuff to supplement the ticket sales. And this year, the film festival was 100% virtual. And so it was still available. We managed to figure it out so that it would be, it was still a fundraiser for grassroots groups. So you could get a ticket for a screening that was, you know, the Montana Backcountry Alliance, for instance, their screening happened from this date to that date. So it wasn't like anytime this winter you could watch the Backcountry Film Festival, but, you know, it was coming to your community at a specific time. And then those ticket sales would be tied to that organization. And some organizations actually saw higher revenue from the Backcountry Film Festival than they normally would, and others, you know, didn't. And it was certainly a learning experience, and we're hoping that, you know, maybe by next winter we can go back to the, you know, more in-person events. But we certainly learned a lot this year about how to operate in a virtual world and still be effective.
Yeah, it's really interesting watching the various film festivals come around, and I, as a consumer, go to a lot of them, and as a volunteer, help out some organizations that put them on. And as you said, it's a mixed bag. There's, I think, some burnout of people watching so much online content that it's one more thing. On the other hand, we can connect with such a wider audience geographically than just the location where the films might have been displayed in person, that it's an interesting shift. Even where the numbers might be flat, it might be a different audience that's being reached.
One other silver lining that I would add to the to this virtual world, back to the kind of policy and land management sphere, in the old days, you know, exactly a year ago, it was near impossible to get representatives from different land management agencies or different units of the Forest Service to get together and talk about practical issues. And I'm now frequently on calls where you've got somebody from the BLM and somebody from the Forest Service, somebody from the Park Service, and from the Highway Department, and everyone's talking about really granular issues. You know, how do we fix the parking? How do we solve the parking issues at the end of this particular road? Whereas in the old days, it would have been impossible to get everybody to on the same phone call to talk. It's just been really interesting to see the evolution of government agencies to this virtual world. And I think on a lot of levels, it's been really productive.
Yeah, that's good to hear. This, just on that note similar to that, a change in administration from our Republican president to a Democratic one, does that impact your nonprofit or not really?
Yeah, I would think this is probably true for anyone working in environmental policy. We have maybe not fully pivoted, but for the last 4 years, we were very much on the defense, you know, working to defend core environmental laws, such as National Environmental Policy Act. You know, we actually took the Trump administration to court to try and stop their gutting of our nation's premier environmental law. A lot of, you know, that administration had instructed, you know, the federal agencies that your priorities are, you know, energy development, timber harvest, a lot of extractive use, and certainly not conservation, not quiet recreation. Climate change was a, you know, something we didn't talk about under the previous administration. And so that really affected our work. And even though we're only 3 months, not even 3 months into the new administration, the priorities are extremely different. And that has already, you know, I think been beneficial for us, you know, that suddenly we care about climate change again. Equity on public lands is a concern and an issue. Planning is important. President Biden outlined, you know, that he shares the goal of protecting 30% of our nation's land and waters by 2030. And in order to do that, we really need to invest in planning. And we do a lot of planning work because you have to figure out, well, what 30% are we going to protect? And that's not all going to be wilderness. Like, what does that protection look like? And where is it, you know, so there's just all these details that allow us to now be working instead of defensively, we're working proactively. And it's kind of a breath of fresh air. It's taking some getting used to, and not everything, you know, is necessarily sunshine and daisies right away. You know, the National Environmental Policy Act, we're still working through that legal process. The Biden administration, I believe, shares our goals of sort of fixing what the Trump administration broke, but it's going to take time. And so it doesn't just happen overnight. And so we have repair work to do as well as proactive work to do.
I'm interested to hear a little more about how Winter Wildlands is approaching, if you've had the opportunity to really sit down and do a strategic assessment of what the 30 by 30 might mean, because as you alluded to, it's not necessarily just cut the nation into one third, but you know, to allocate it according to things that make sense. And applying that with a winter use lens, what are some of your priorities that you use the 30-30 vision to move forward?
Well, I can speak a little bit to that because out in California, Hillary and I kind of split a little bit our regional focus, and I do a lot of work with our broader coalition, which is Outdoor Alliance. And California was really, is kind of leading in terms of figuring out what 30 by 30 really is. There was a governor's executive order basically saying, you know, we need to sit down and hash that out and figure out, because obviously we're not going to get to 30% just with wilderness. So what are these other designations and that will count, and what counts in terms of working landscapes, and you know, if there's grazing, does that mean it doesn't contribute to 30 by 30? If there's oil and gas development, and that has yet to be hashed out, and I think will take a couple of years to work through, but we're sitting on those steering committees and having those discussions, and we've already, it's something that we've been engaged in for quite a while. You know, really, how do we manage roadless areas and how do we protect those? Certainly that's a big piece of it, is the roadless area and keeping them roadless. And then as they shift into wintertime, you know, how do we keep them non-motorized, not just roadless? Obviously in the summer, you can't just drive everywhere you want to drive, but in the winter, it's much easier to just travel over snow with a vehicle. So that's really right at the core of what we do on these travel management plans.
Yeah. Well, and I want to add too, so, you know, the underlying sort of vision with 30 by 30 is it's not just protecting 30% of land and water for the heck of it, but it's to protect biodiversity. And as we were talking about earlier in regards to wildlife, not every acre of land is created equal from, you know, an animal's perspective. And so understanding where those biodiversity hotspots are and what sort of activities impact biodiversity and which sort of activities maybe don't have an impact, because that helps to drive, you know, we want to protect the places with the highest amount of biodiversity or where biodiversity is most threatened. And the type of protection depends on what threatens the biodiversity in that particular place. So if you're trying to protect, you know, a winter sensitive wildlife species, then making sure that in the wintertime that animal's winter habitat is undisturbed, not just from physical development like logging or ski resorts, but also, you know, if motorized recreation poses a threat to that species, then you want to make sure that that area is not open to motorized recreation.
Another piece that's really important to me on the 30 by 30 and that I think is a huge opportunity for all of us is to sort of graduate from thinking about discrete land parcels and start thinking about connectivity, not just in terms of, you know, obviously for wildlife migration, but also for connectivity between communities and for getting people out of cars and you know, connecting with trails and being able to ski from one place to another without crossing roads, things like that. I think that's another big opportunity for us over the next decade.
Yeah, there's some huge big picture questions here that we could probably spend a lot of time on. And just keeping an eye on the clock, though, we do have some specific programmatic areas that Winter Wildlands has been working on that we should touch base on. So let's look at some of the specific initiatives that your organization's been engaged in. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about each, and we'll start maybe with the Ski Kind program.
Sure. And that kind of grew out of the discussion that we just had about COVID impacts and increased visitor use and explosion in backcountry user numbers, backcountry equipment sales. And I was on one of the early steering committees of the Recreate Responsibly Coalition, which is another of the silver linings in this virtual world, has grown to be this huge national coalition of companies and NGOs and land management agencies all working around trying to create messaging to just remind people to leave no trace and to look out for other people. And obviously all of the sort of CDC guidelines that have been filtering down to the trailheads. But we wanted to try to reach a more, our specific audience. And that was kind of where the Ski Kind concept came. And it was working with avalanche educators and guides. And one of our grassroots partners in New Hampshire kind of came up with the concept of Ski Kind. And we broke that down into a number of different elements. Some groups have used it for trailhead signage. We've created a website with some resources. We created a logo and got some stickers out and about, and people seem to have really gotten the concept. It's one of those simple sort of things. You know, if you've got the Ski Kind hat on, people tend to be nice to you. So we're just trying to spread that out. Now, some of it also came out of, 4 years of sort of incredible divisiveness that translated even to the trailhead and to the trails, where people were just battling fighting each other over different uses. And so really just trying to remind people to be generous and inclusive.
I was just going to say that I can imagine these uses could be very contentious. Snowmobilers with Nordic skiers, et cetera. That's a big challenge.
It's a huge challenge.
Huge. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm trying to dig out of the back of my memory of an article I read fairly recently, again, about some really distinct problems to a distinct area there west of Denver, where one of the ski areas that's easily accessed a lot of backcountry closed, and the literal fistfights in the park and ride lots to hitch rides to the top of the mountain to ski down. I think it's the A-Basin area, if you're familiar with that. But.
Oh, yeah.
I think that it sounds like they needed a healthy dose of the Ski Kind program at a certain point last March, April. How does this differ from or similar to your Recreate Responsibility? Is one an offshoot of the other?
Yeah, Ski Kind is an offshoot of the Recreate Responsibly Coalition, which is a much more national, much more broad messaging effort to try to reach really all outdoor recreationists. Whereas ours was much more focused on kind of our core backcountry community as it grows. And again, part of it was one of the things that we realized, as locals in the mountains, it was at first sort of shocking and uncomfortable for us to see all these new users. And it's really important for us to remind ourselves that, hey, no, you know, these are indeed public lands, and it's really a good thing to have more people out and about and appreciating these places. And it's on those of us who are local to welcome folks in, rather than fighting to keep our stashes private or being obnoxious to people for not necessarily knowing the ground rules.
Yeah, education is everything. And to that end, I have a note about Snow Rangers. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so the Snow Rangers program, the interesting thing that we found is kind of in the vacuum that's been created really over the last few decades, where less and less, fewer and fewer resources have been given to agencies for interpretive services and have rangers on the ground. That vacuum has been filled more and more by outside organizations. And one of our grassroots groups is Colorado Mountain Club. And of course, the irony is they're a much bigger organization than we are, but we advise them on certain national policy issues and Forest Service processes. And they started this little Snow Rangers program where they have two Forest Service, they're Forest Service employees, but they're paid for in part by Colorado Mountain Club. And they have snowmobiles and backcountry gear, and they're sort of out, not really patrolling. It's not a law enforcement effort, but it's more of just a visitor interaction and meeting people out there and reminding folks where they can and can't go, but also just being helpful, being a presence on the ground, which is something that a lot of times the Forest Service just doesn't have resources for.
It sounds like our GOAT Ambassador program with Friends of Scotchman Peaks, Phil.
Yeah, something similar where it's really a one-on-one Leave No Trace education.
That's one of the things that we've realized is that every organization, every one of our grassroots groups, I mean, here locally in Mammoth, we've got four different programs, whether it's, you know, you call it a trail host, you call it a trail ambassador, you call it a snow ranger, but really important efforts. And one of the things we've been working on a lot over the last 6 to 8 months is trying to figure out how to coordinate all those groups and, you know, kind of elevate the public perception of what that is to have a volunteer on the ground, what the scope of their work is and the value of it, especially in the absence of visitor centers and other efforts.
So I'm wondering if they fill part of the role of the next question I'm going to ask, which is with this increased use over the last decade and maybe dramatically this last winter, seeing more people in a not larger space in the backcountry seems inherently like it would increase the risk for injuries just on a numerical basis, but also that increase might lead to some snowpack instability and actually help trigger avalanches. And how is that impacting search and rescue? How is your organization working to mitigate the danger and or provide resources for safe recreation?
Yeah, well, it certainly has impacted. I mean, this is clearly the deadliest year in avalanche fatalities really ever in history. There was one particularly bad year. I think it was 1910, but it was mostly around building railroads over Stevens Pass and then up in Canada. But yeah, it's been kind of a perfect storm of climate change creating really unstable snowpacks all across the West. It's definitely the most unstable snowpack we've ever seen in California in recorded history. And that combined with this increased use and people pushing farther and farther in the backcountry, trying to separate themselves from others. People are skiing in places where they previously wouldn't have. There's this scarcity heuristic is driving people to take risks that they even experts who've been in the backcountry for a long time are taking risks that they know they probably shouldn't. And some of them are learning the hard way to remind themselves about hubris. And it's been tricky business. And certainly everyone I know in search and rescue has been busier than they've ever been all year round. And we feel like our role at this point is really at the sort of messaging level and just providing tools and helping our grassroots groups to increase the consciousness around the hazards that are out there.
I will add for our local listeners, and I would imagine there's similar resources around the country, but locally here, the Panhandle Avalanche Center puts out a lot of information about the risk assessment. So the know before you go is a strong urge. And then they and several other organizations offer throughout the winter season various levels of classes for avalanche awareness, and certainly to go into the backcountry, well advised to take one of those, go with someone who has taken one of those, and again, know your risk before you go. And I suspect that same advice could be applied, just fill in the blank with the details of the organization throughout the country.
Yeah, there are definitely a number of avalanche centers all throughout the West, and I believe there might even be one in New England. And one of the first principles of ski kind is know before you go. It's not just be nice to people, but you know, understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
Well, what have we missed? Is there any other program or event you'd like to talk about?
Well, speaking of Ski Kind, we actually have a Ski Kind Film Fest that's coming up. It's launching this Monday. This is, you know, our always trying to try new things and reach people. And the Backcountry Film Festival is wrapping up for the season. And the Ski Kind Film Fest is a little bit different. It's not just backcountry focused. It's got some resort films. And it kind of has films that highlight all the principles of Ski Kind. And so you go to skikind.org and I believe there'll be information about it on there, and it launches Monday and it'll run for about a month into April. So that's coming up. And then also, you know, people can go to our website, winterwildlands.org, and find out we've got, you can sign up to get our newsletter. We have an action center there where folks can check out, you know, what's going on and what ways they could take action.
Very good. And we would be remiss not to mention one of the local affiliates that Winter Wildlands has worked with to bring the Backcountry Film Festival and Snow School to our area. That's the Selkirk Outdoor Leadership and Education Organization, which are frequent guests on the show. And we often speak with them about their local version of these programs. But to make sure listeners connect the dots here, just good to remind folks that there is a local face to this national organization.
Definitely, yeah. They are longtime friends of Winter Wildlands Alliance.
All right. Well, if someone wanted to become a member and contribute to the Winter Wildlands Alliance, how would they do that, Hillary?
You can do it on our website. So it's a one-stop shop for anything you could ever imagine Winter Wildlands-wise. So that's, again, www.winterwildlands.org.
And you can sign up to get our newsletter or our, we put out a magazine called Trail Break a couple times a year. There's also a web store where you can buy Ski Kind caps and eco-friendly ski wax and all sorts of things. And all the proceeds for those things benefit our programs.
All right, well, then we will wrap this up. And this has been the KRFY Community Conversations. We've been joined by the Winter Wildlands Alliance with our guests today, Hillary Eisen and David Page. Hillary's the policy director and David is the advocacy director. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great chat.
Hey, thank you, Julie, and thank you, Phil, and we'll talk to you guys later.
Well, this wraps up another community conversation. Thanks for tuning in to KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho and beyond. All of our programs can be heard live streaming on the web at krfy.org, and all of our community conversation shows are later posted as podcasts and available on our website. KRFY strives to bring our community important local information. Even as vaccinations roll out, impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic remain at significant levels across our country, our county, our state, and our region. It is recommended we all follow the Panhandle Health District and government guidelines. Please wear a mask in public, especially inside buildings and businesses. Keep a 6-foot distance apart, wash up, and stay at home as much as possible. And stay home if you are sick. If we all help each other, we can get through this together. So let's be good neighbors and friends and protect each other. Before we close, we have a new feature here at KRFY. If you'd like to find out more information about the song you just heard, you can go to our webpage or our Facebook page. Once there, find the playlist link, and then you can see the name of the song and the artist who performed it. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.